Good. So the title is Pressure-Driven Flow in Solid Helium. So I'm talking about experiments that we've been doing over the last year and a half at the University of Alberta. James Day is the graduate student who actually did most of these measurements. He's currently in the process of moving my lab, so there's no experiments underway. I've got a new lab starting this week, so he's back there working on that. So what I thought I'd do in the time today was the two experiments really that we've done. One is to look at what happens to solid helium in the pores of ichor and see if we can induce flow there, since that was where Moses basically first saw some decoupling in his oscillators. But then since then we've done measurements in bulk, like solid helium. If there's time, I'd like to talk a little bit about some, just because having looked on the web at some of the talks last week, I was kind of wish I'd been here last week, but obviously this is a big issue, the question of annealing. And since we're doing kind of plastic flow type experiments where we are sure we must be generating defects, we did some things that look like annealing, and not as an attempt to study the effects of annealing on this, but rather just as part of our crystal growth and experiments. So I thought I'd talk about those, even though they're sort of incomplete, just to give a feeling experimentally for what kind of annealing actually happens in helium crystals. And if there's time, too, I might just say a few words about dislocations in helium, just because dislocations are kind of my favorite defect, right, from my graduate student days. So just to introduce it, in Vicor, since I'll start talking about the Vicor experiments, they're the first ones we did, this is the phase diagram in Vicor. In other words, basically, the melting curve is shifted to higher pressure or lower temperature. In small pores, the few nanometer pores of ichor, you have to apply extra pressure or cool further in order to force it to freeze, basically because of interfacial energies that are required. And so the curve up here is just showing the thermodynamic path that you'd follow. So basically, or that something like the path that Moses would have followed, is that you would start in the liquid phase where you have bulk. In our case, we have a sample of Vicor inside a cell, and there's some bulk helium. So what first thing will happen as you cool it, because you're cooling at constant volume, is that you will hit the bulk melting curve, and the bulk around it will freeze, and as it freezes, you'll drop down the melting curve. And then at this point, all the bulk will be frozen, but the bulk inside the helium inside the Vicor is not, and so you'll have to cool further. So this is the undercooling that's required because of the pores. At some point, though, you will start to freeze the helium in the pores. The pressure will drop a bit as it freezes. And then at this point, everything will be frozen. So at this point in this green area, you should be in the solid phase inside the pores of ichor. And here's, of course, Moses' results. And what I want to point out, first of all, in this linear scale, is that the region of interest is this part down below about 0.2 Kelvin. This corresponds roughly, I think, to Moses' first experiment, 60 bar in the solid phase. And it should be well into the Vicor, the solid helium region in Vicor. So that's the region of interest. And this other effect that is really important to the experiments that, or at least to the interpretation of what I want to talk about, is the fact that there's an amplitude dependence, or what can be interpreted as a critical velocity. The harder you shake the oscillator, the larger the velocities you try to induce, the less it wants to flow. And that this critical velocity is quite low. It's in the order of tens of microns per second. Okay, so for flow experiments, if you think of just a superfluid, liquid helium, for example, conceptually the simplest sort of thing is that you would have a superleak, some channels, capillaries, whatever you're trying to measure flow through, and you just have two big reservoirs, and you might imagine just sliding a piston and pushing through these channels at a constant velocity. Now that would be the equivalent of driving a constant current through a resistor. And then what you would do in principle is measure the pressure difference that this flow induces across here, the equivalent of measuring the voltage. So you're measuring the flow resistance through pressure and mass flow. Now in liquid helium in small channels, some old data at about 1 Kelvin, what happens, of course, is when you're in the superfluid state, you can drive a small current, a small flow through those channels with absolutely no dissipation, with no pressure difference. So the pressure is zero up to some critical velocity of the order, in this case, of centimeters per second. Once you exceed that critical velocity, if you push harder, you start to see dissipation and a pressure difference across the channels. And if you push harder and faster, the pressure difference gets larger. Or if you do it in a different way, if you apply a pressure difference across the channels, then you must be up here. As soon as you apply a finite difference, you'll go right immediately to the critical velocity, and then depending on the pressure, to some slightly higher velocity. So if you push harder, have a bigger pressure difference, it doesn't stop flowing, it just it flows a little bit faster, but dissipatively. Okay, and just one thing I found sort of interesting in the solid helium experiments, this is liquid again. What's known in liquid helium is that the critical flow velocity, the critical velocity for dissipation, is quite dependent on the size of the channel, right? The small channels over here have rather large flow velocities, critical velocities. So in a 10 nanometer channel, you might expect a flow critical velocity of the order of meter per second. On the other hand, if you're macroscopic and you have millimeter-sized channels, you can generate vortices more easily, and you get a flow critical velocity that's much smaller, of the order of 100 microns per second. So you do expect large size-dependent effect on the critical velocity.
Is that something that's
supposed to be a room full of theorists, and you ask me. Yeah, I mean, you can argue in a simple way, you can argue that you have to generate vortex rings or something to create dissipation. That's the lowest energy one, and the bigger they are, the easier it is to generate them. So that would give you, I think, this 1 over D. I don't think that's the state of the art in terms of theory by any means.
Threshold for generating turbulence.
Yeah, of some sort. And it's certainly the bigger the loop or the bigger the eddy is, the easier it is to do at a lower velocity. So certainly the generic idea that you're generating some sort of a presumably quantized eddy or something like that is just hard to do in a very small channel. It's very energetically unfavorable.
I'm just wondering whether you understand what
are the... Oh, I don't know that it is.
It's well understood.
I think it is well understood, and I don't think 1 over D is a state of the art. I think that that's just the simplest picture of it. But anyway, experimentally, you know, you have orders of magnitude difference over this size range. And then, if you look at Moses' results in Vicor and in bulk, remember, this is a couple of nanometers per second, so it's even off to the left there, the channels in Vicor. And this, of course, is the order of millimeter. And what you see is, despite this huge orders of magnitude, you know, many orders of magnitude difference in channel sizes, you get, roughly speaking, the same critical velocity.
So how does that go over to that graph?
Sorry?
Let's see.
So Vicor is over here, where if it were liquid helium, you'd expect a critical velocity of the order of meters per second. So it's a great, this is, like Moses always said, this is an incredibly small flow velocity. It's very easy to disrupt in the Vicor. It's not such a big deal over here in the sense that it's not that different from liquid when you get into millimeter channels. The flow velocities in liquid helium are only of the order of a fraction of a millimeter per second.
You don't have to do that so there. So 10 micrometers a second is down one more order.
Yeah, sorry, 10.
So
100 microns per second is here. So 10 microns per second would be over here. So if you had a centimeter-sized channel, you might say that's ballpark what you'd expect in liquid helium, and this has nothing to do with solid.
But then this due will be this is the beginning onset of dissipation. I mean, the thing doesn't go away. Right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So all I'm really trying to say is that if this was liquid and you understood it as a superfluid, you'd expect a huge difference in critical velocity between a nanometer size and millimeter size pores, and that these experiments don't show very much. So I think that's just, you know, it's just telling you that it is not a channel size vortex creating the dissipation.
They are identical to the two different size channels.
Pardon me?
These critical velocities curves are not identical.
Oh, no, of course not. And Moses has nicer ones. But I think if the nicest ones I've seen of yours show a pretty nice flat spot up to a collapse and flat spot up to 10 microns in bulk, the data just is nowhere near as good in Vicor. I mean, it's just you haven't repeated it with all the care and attention. But it's not, or I mean, it's ballpark the same, right? I mean, in other words, there's a amplitude dependence down to 10. There's certainly one down to here, and probably this looks like it's flattening out. So it's not orders of magnitude different is all I'm really pointing out here. So when we started this, we were kind of worried by the original experiments of Moses and Vicor that because it's a complicated system with very small pores, and you know we have a lot of interfaces, you worry that you don't know for sure that there's 100% frozen, you don't know for sure there isn't a film, and et cetera. So looked at all the experimental data to say, you know, can you really say, we know something freezes, but we don't know absolutely every atom freezes. In fact, we're pretty sure they don't. So we wanted to try to see experimentally what we could say about that possibility in the Vicor. And in the process, we hope to rule out just any old, experimental artifact that would have nothing to do with superfluidity. So, for example, in a torsional oscillator, even though all the helium may stay in there, if it redistributes itself, if it moves out of the pores or into the pores, you change the moment of inertia, and that can mimic decoupling, just a rearrangement rather than a decoupling. So we want to rule that out as what, is there any movement in or out of the pores in solid helium in Vicor? And then, of course, what we're really interested in, so all of this has nothing to do with flow, it just has to do with ruling out other things. What we're really interested in is trying to see how it flows in a different way, not a torsional oscillator, but just apply a pressure difference, try to do what people do with liquid helium superflow. And then, of course, particularly...
Actually, the great problem that you discussed in the previous
It's not clear at all. I don't think. Yeah. I mean, one's an AC one.
Some sort of critical velocity which excites some excitations.
Well, I mean, these ones are not thermal, of course. This is low temperature, but you're right. One's a low amplitude AC excitation. It's not clear you'd excite this kind of things. I mean, there are different.
Yeah,
I agree.
Actually, I would like to discuss this thing in my talk. Mm-hmm. So far.
Right.
This is one point of discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, it's not clear. Not clear they're the same thing. But on the other hand, I want to, because the question of critical velocity will come up in any flow experiment, right? Okay, and so fairly quickly, I mean, even Moses' original stuff in Vicor showed that there was a reasonable sensitivity to helium-3 impurities at the tens of parts per million level anyway, and more recently, I guess, on the web, I listened to the talks, and it's obvious that by getting rid of helium-3 impurities down to the... I know it's my... It's two parts per billion, Moses, not one. I do not have the original ones. It's Bureau of Mines helium. The paper published by Jürgen Frank using that helium quotes it as two parts per billion, and that's the best I know. And I don't know if that means they guarantee that or they measure that. Do you know, John?
Yeah, they measured it.
So I'm guessing that's based on a measurement at the time, and I can't find the paperwork. And Jürgen.
I thought Moses was right that it was. I still have the paperwork. On.
Well, but I don't know if it's always the same. I mean, if they sell the same, I think they individually analyze the cylinders. So the question of whether the cylinder that Jürgen Frank bought in 1977 or something is
yeah,
was
he got it a lot earlier. Than
so, but
and
it.
How would they measure that?
Mass spectrometry, yeah, and they can't anymore.
No one can do it anymore.
They do it spectroscopically now. I think there's Japanese people that do it down the part per billion spectroscopically.
Is that right?
Yeah, a few parts per billion anyway. It seems in Gaswell about 0.3 parts per million. It seems reasonably consistent at that.
Natural,
not in the atmosphere, though.
In the atmosphere, it's
much higher.
Wow. Okay, then you can trace it to some nuclear interaction.
Oh, that'd be great.
But however, the Texas gas well,
which is where you get your stuff from.
Everyone gets it, right? I mean, there's nothing unusual. Then you listen to who you talk to. Sometimes they say 0.2 ppm, sometimes they say 0.3 ppm.
Yeah.
Much, much bigger than the concentrations.
Oh, yeah, hundreds of times. Yeah, so they purify it, they remove at least 99% of the helium-3 in the purified stuff, the isotopically purified stuff. I thought they'd, by evaporation out of the helium-4, I think, but I'm not...
Helium-3.
No, I mean...
I don't think so. I think they use the superfluid.
They would heat flush? I mean, I know that's how it's done now. I'm not 100% sure how they did it in the Bureau of Mines. Okay. So anyway, and then finally, I hope I do have a bit of time to say a bit, because we didn't at the time think too much about annealing, except in the sense we wanted to start from the most uniform crystal we could before we started deforming it. So we did some annealing, but because we can measure things like pressures as we do it, I can maybe say a little bit about how real helium crystals really do anneal, at least in some sense, near melting. And probably invisible. So the Vicor results were published, you know, 6 or 8 months ago, and the bulk helium results will come out in a few weeks, and they're on CONMAT. Okay, so starting with the experiment. So I thought, because apparently an awful lot of what we see depends on exactly how you do the experiment anneal it, I thought I'd show you in a little bit of detail, certainly more than in a paper, how the actual experiment is done. So the idea of the Vicor one is I'm going to try to push on helium, force it into the pores, see if it flows into the pores. The way I monitor whether it's flowing is by measuring the density of the helium in the pores, the average density, and the technique I do use to measure the density inside the pores is capacitively, use the dielectric properties of helium. So the idea is that, you know, I take a slice of Vicor, maybe a millimeter thick and a centimeter in diameter, and I evaporate on either side of it nice copper electrodes to turn it into a Vicor dielectric capacitor with a few picofarads capacitance. So here, if people can see that low, here's a schematic of it. I made sure when I evaporated the electrodes, they're all perforated so that the helium can flow through the electrodes. And then I put it inside a cell, so a PowerPoint cell you can see into. It's just sitting inside of there with the leads coming in, a fill line to fill it. And I also put a pressure gauge, a sensitive pressure gauge, so I can in situ measure the pressure as I do things. And the real thing looks a little messier.
Yeah. You only measure the pressure difference between the two cells.
Okay, this is one where in Vicor, I don't measure pressure difference. I change the pressure in the surrounding helium. So you've got a sample of Vicor surrounded by quite a bit of bulk helium, and I measure the pressure in the bulk helium around it. This is not the squeezing part yet. I've not come to that yet. Well, it's completely surrounded by, it's just sitting in there. This is the first set of experiments. I'm not yet doing any pressure flow. I'm just going to look at this. So this is the first step. Okay. Now, and the capacitance, well, capacitance is just geometric. It just depends on the area and the dielectric constant. Now, if I put in, so I've got a porosity phi, so 28% of the space is open and full of helium, 28%. This is the change between the dielectric constant of helium and the vacuum before you put the helium in, and then that times the capacitance is how much it changes. So we also know that the dielectric constant of the contribution to the dielectric constant of helium is proportional to the density of helium. And so therefore the change in capacitance is just giving you a measure of the change in density in the pores. And we can calibrate it if we want.
So you just said this, but I'm just interested. Why is the volume fraction?
This, right. Obviously, if there's only a few pores, it doesn't make that much difference to fill them with helium. 28% in Vicor.
What is
actual
helium?
Pardon me?
What is actual helium?
About 1.05 for liquid helium at that density, so it's a 5% correction to vacuum. It's not a big effect. But capacitance you can measure with more resolution and stability than almost anything else you can imagine. Experimentalists love it. Okay, so this experiment, so the way we freeze and all the experiments we've been able to do so far is at constant volume. You block off the capillary, you start with liquid at high pressure, and you let it contract and freeze. And so here's this is the thermodynamic path that we follow in these experiments, starting in the liquid at high pressure, right? This is the bulk melting curve. So at some point B, we start to freeze the bulk around it. We fall down the melting curve. At this point, all of the bulk in the cell is frozen. The Vicor's pores are filled still with liquid helium. So down here, even though the bulk is frozen, the liquid is still the pores are still filled with liquid. And then we cool further, and down here at a point marked D, the helium in the pores actually finally freezes. You can't see it here. If you look, so this is just simply measuring the pressure. The blue points are data. That's the pressure, and the black is the known melting curve of helium. The data for the density, capacitance here, just read density, except there's a little background. So this slope, this background slope has nothing to do, that would be there even before you put helium in. It's just a glass. It's got temperature-dependent dielectric properties. But there's a background slope, but what you see at point B when the bulk starts to freeze and the pressure starts to drop is that the density in the pore starts to drop. Well, that's just because the pressure outside drops, some of the liquid helium in the pores, which is at high pressure, just gets pushed out. So the density really does drop, okay? But at this point, point C, that stops because all the helium outside is frozen. The pressure now stays constant and nothing happens, but at some point D, suddenly the density of helium in the pores goes up quite quickly. That's because it freezes. When it freezes, the density of solid helium is higher than the density of liquid helium, so it sucks back in some of the helium from outside because the outside's a pressure reservoir. So
I'm puzzled as to how that happens if all the helium outside is solid.
It does just fine, though. I mean, it stays in pressure equilibrium with a solid outside by diffusion, I believe. Easily.
I know that's true, but I find it puzzling because we know that the block capillary technique works, which means that the helium in the capillary can support a tremendous amount of shear. And these Vicor openings are much smaller than any capillary we need to sort.
But vacancy diffusion will just carry mass just fine. It's not that hard at all, near melting. I mean, if I cooled it down really rapidly, all this would not necessarily happen. If I got it quite cold, it would not happen. It's because, and this isn't really incredibly slow. I mean, this may take me, who knows, 12 hours or something. It's not incredibly slow. But up here, it does stay in perfectly good pressure equilibrium. I mean, you'll see that even more clearly and how fast that happens when I show you what happens when you squeeze outside. But it does. And I believe it's vacancy activated flow. It's just diffusion of vacancies and mass transport into the port.
Does anyone know what the vacancy diffusion constants in, say, bulk? Solid
helium
with those temperatures on, is it reasonable based on those?
Yeah. I mean, you don't directly measure them because, you know, the way you measure vacancy diffusion typically is by NMR if you've got a spin. So you can measure how helium-3 diffuses around. You can measure the activation energy for vacancies, and they seem to agree in the sense that the way helium-3 moves around in helium-4 is by vacancies moving around. You believe that helium-4 also moves around in helium-4. But if you want to measure the vacancy diffusion you directly in of helium 4 and helium 4, you probably do something like what we just did. Is that's your measurement? Sure. I mean, but they're all kind of plastic. Yeah. They're all kind of flow experiments. So ours is as good a way as any to measure it. But I'm using that as an interpretation, right? So, but yeah, yes. But there is, then I'll show you maybe in Vicor.
I mean, you know, some materials at these temperatures would be crazy to suggest that vacancies would diffuse that far in that amount of time.
Well, I think the relevant thing is that at above about half the melting temperature, you expect quite a bit of vacancy diffusion independently of what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is herring the barrel creep, and in metallurgy, it's above half the melting temperature that you pay attention. That's why you have to replace turbine blades in jet aircraft. Okay, so the interesting part from our point of view is not the bulk freezing, but it's the Vicor. So blowing this up a little bit, you just see here's coming down the melting curve. Here's the end of bulk freezing. Nothing happens. Here's the curve I was showing you. Here's the jump associated with the density difference between solid and liquid. If I turn around, in pores, it's always this way. If I warm up, you get hysteresis. So I'm not too worried about that. I'm worried about what goes on down here, but there's certainly hysteresis between melting and freezing. There always is in small pores. And so if I take this jump and calibrate everything in terms of capacitance and density, I should be able to tell how much the density changed in going through this freezing transition. In other words, if that was the same as the 6% or so the density changes in bulk, I would be confident in saying that it looks like all helium freezes, or at least up to the extent that helium in small channels is the same as in bulk. If it's smaller than that, you have the out of maybe it doesn't all freeze. Okay, so I can calibrate that, and if I do that, I find that this jump corresponds to about 3% change in density. Now that's about half the density change that you would expect if bulk froze. Now that doesn't prove that it's liquid by any means, okay? And so you could say maybe not all of the helium freezes. Well, that's certainly true. We believe that the first two monolayers, which are something like a quarter to a third of the helium, is just highly immobilized, disordered, and you don't expect it to participate in crystallization, right? From X-ray scattering, et cetera, you know that it stays amorphous. So that doesn't participate in freezing. It doesn't mean it's liquid. It's highly immobile. And so the amount that's left over, this doesn't rule it out, okay? Doesn't rule out there being a liquid layer, but it certainly says that the bulk of the helium, except for those first inert layers, does freeze, does crystallize. Now, the other thing we could do is, if you believe that there was a liquid layer, you might say, well, why don't you just squeeze it harder? And presumably, if you squeeze hard enough, you can force it to freeze, or at least you might expect more to freeze if you do it at higher pressure. Because we're noticeably, this I guess I didn't mention that, this isn't that high a pressure. This was at a pressure about 40 bar. It's Oh yeah, you hadn't mentioned it, but okay, so it's 39 bar or something like that, right? Now that's into the bulk phase, but not as high as the data of Moses I showed you. So you can try. You can just go up higher in pressure and say, does more of it freeze? And so if we do that, we went to 48 and 54 bar. Now this is getting close to where Moses was. And then this jump is again telling you, again, how much the density changes, how much freezes, if you like, as a function of pressure. And if you look at these, they look about the same. If I do it as carefully as I can go to lower pressure, I go just a hair above the the melting curve in Vicor, like a fraction of a bar, so that if I drop the pressure by a couple tenths of a bar, it won't freeze at all in the Vicor. If I go just a hair above that, or all the way up to the highest pressure we happen to do this at, there's no difference to the accuracy of our measurements, the same density change, and you can interpret that as being the same amount freezing. And so there's no pressure difference. So either, if there is liquid layer left, it's very hard to freeze. I'd have to obviously go to much higher pressure or do something different, or else maybe there just isn't anything significant left except for this inert layer and the crystal. Yeah.
I just point out that this is what our simulation shows, in fact, that the second and third layer, this inert layer, is still amorphous, and it's very resistant to pressure. I mean, there would be, it's just because the energy scales are different, right? The amount of energy you put in when you pressurize is much less than absorption energy.
Yeah.
And so,
I agree. I think what this really would be saying is that you can't expect it to be several layers. If you had if you had the Greg Dash's four layers, then I think you would rule that out because you can't possibly have it that stable. But the one layer that has a much higher energy to order it is plausible. Yeah.
But is that plausible in terms of this bigger pressure difference, density difference? I mean, is half of the are you saying that half of the
I think if you take the
is within one layer
within okay roughly the first couple of layers are immobilized on the surface, and that can be as much as a third of it.
Well, maybe only one, though.
Maybe 1 to 2, but maybe, okay. So if you take superfluidity in thin films, it's 1.5 or a bit more is it the inert layer in Vicor or something like that, right? This is all plausible. The answer is roughly yeah. That if you took 1.5 layers of inert, one layer of disordered or a little bit more, it could be approximately half of it. The other thing you don't know, of course, is that does it crystallize into the same density, right? Is the density change of the crystalline part the same as in bulk, right? It could be highly, it will be fairly strained, I assume, lots of grain boundaries. So it's not implausible. And unfortunately, you can't rule out with this kind of experiment at the one monolayer of something liquid or mobile.
Yeah. The fraction of the volume is taken up by the Vicor itself.
Of the total cell? Of the total cell? Or of the...
The total of the sample. I mean, in other words, the volume change would be reduced compared to pure helium.
Oh, that's all calibrated into this. So it's 28% by volume, and so I say...
But that's correct.
Yes, yeah. This is just the density change of the... I mean, it's comparing the density of the liquid to the density of the solid with all the porosities and stuff factored out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if this interpretation is right, though, that would say that if you did this in a system with bigger core, this would get
volume. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Experiments like that been done? Are you planning to do experiments like that? Is someone planning to do experiments like that?
I mean, there have been over the years lots of different freezing and different pore sizes. Where how much you supercool, presumably all these other things, yeah. I mean, in helium, there's a variety of not incredibly well characterized different pore size things, and but in terms of this, I don't know that anybody's measured that as systematically.
Humphrey Meredith and Seidel have intentionally made Vicor glass like pores much smaller because they were trying very hard to try to actually have supercool hydrogen, liquid hydrogen. They make things up that are on the 15th angstrom.
They
find the freezing point.
You can track. People have studied the temperature at which it freezes, but no, I think the answer is that people have not very systematically at all studied the density change associated with that. They have in all kinds of other materials, like the latent heat, how it scales with pore size in indium water, all kinds of things. But helium, there's a scattered experiments. I don't think people would be surprised if you went to big pores if that didn't become close to bulk. But I don't think anybody's very systematically measured the density change associated with freezing.
It seems like if you did that, you could settle this question. There's a definite scaling that would follow from assuming that everything is bulk except...
Sure.
And so if I systematically looking at it as a function of scale size, you could settle the question you got up with.
Yeah. I don't know experimentally if you could settle the question of is there still one or two monolayers of mobile stuff at the surface? It'll get...
You could show that that's all it is.
Well, sure. I mean, this already says that it can't be more than one or two monolayers because there's not that much helium. I mean, one or two monolayers is a good fraction of in Vicor. So it certainly of the order of a monolayer, no more than two can possibly be fluid, and it can be it's very resistant to freezing by just pressurizing more.
And it's kind of a complicated thing, as you were saying, like there may be parts of that second layer that are really frozen and parts that are really quite mobile.
Yeah.
Of the random potential.
Yeah, I think it'd be straightforward to do that if you want to just get a bunch of control pore glasses of different sizes and do this. People really have done this a lot in, you know, conventional fluids and solids. They're very interested in that water or something like that. Okay, so that was the first question, which unfortunately we leave ambiguous in the sense that we cannot rule out, you know, something of the order of monolayer of non-crystalline mobile stuff, but. At least we know that most of it freezes and nothing much changes with pressure when we freeze it. So the next thing is we want to look at the density change by measuring the capacitance at low temperature and just see if something happens. Like by, you know, worst case, you know, there's a phase transition at 0.2 Kelvin from one crystallographic phase to another and densities are different and the helium decides to leave and it all looks like a decoupling.
Yeah, that is the point that the neutron scattering shows that there is a BCC-HCP transition. Is that possible that there could be.
I mean, those experiments aren't done specifically in Vicor. They're done in similar type glasses, I think. I think it's still true that there's no actual experimental diffraction data that tells you it's crystalline. I've published in Vicor per se. There's very similar glasses, similar pore size glasses that people have done the neutron scattering and stuff and see crystalline things. But there's a long history of other things like argon and stuff in these glasses of doing the scattering and asking, you know, what is it HCP? Is it disordered HCP? Is it this? Is it that? And my guess is that there's a lot of answers you can get if you want.
I mean, it must be pretty hard to tell if poison only a few atomic layers thick. You're not going to get beautiful short delta function peaks in the nuclear crystallography.
It's not easy, but in similar glasses, there have been, in particular in recent years, neutron scattering. I think Henry Glide and people would claim they've seen diffraction peaks in neutron scattering in similar glasses. Yeah.
Or a certain fraction of BCC.
And the resolution is good enough to tell BCC from HCC?
Yes. There are models. I mean, I take all of it with a grain of salt because there's a long history of things like argon and xenon and stuff in these pores and, you know, and transitions from one to the other, disordered this, disordered that. I mean, it's not that easy to be sure what you're seeing. And helium's harder than other things. You know, that's why neutron scattering, not X-ray scattering, I think. Okay, now this just show you, this is the result. This is full of solid helium. This looks like something big is going on. This is all, sorry?
Pure
helium?
This is
Vicor containing solid helium. Yeah. And that temperature dependence is just the dielectric constant temperature dependence of a glass. It would be very similar to that if I didn't put the helium in it. So that's a background that I have to look at what happens on top. Unfortunately, it's quite a big background. So what I'm showing is that if something suddenly left the pores, if the 1% decoupling Moses saw corresponded to 1% of the helium leaving the pores, this is how big a jump or change you would see. And if it was leaving the pores, you'd expect to see it drop. And that's kind of the temperature region where it would start to drop. And you certainly don't have any evidence for anything like that in here. There's no evidence of something leaving the pores, you know, at 100 or 150 millikelvin.
Is this also at 60 bars?
Good question. I don't have it on it, and I can't remember which. It looks the same in all of them. You see something the same at, you know, 36 bars or 50.
The minimum, a lot of change in the density, I
think. Remember, this is the glass. The background and the minimum have to do with the glass, not the helium. So
this is the glass.
The background you see, what I'm saying is that the background there has to do with the two-level systems and the dielectric properties of the glass. When I put helium in, it does shift the minimum around a bit, the effect of helium, but just smoothly. And so all I'm looking for, though, is on top of that is a density change associated with the, and I don't see anything. It's unfortunate. There's a big background temperature dependence that has nothing to do with the helium. Or almost nothing to do with helium.
I'm sorry, I missed something. Why should helium leave when it becomes superfluid?
No, I'm at this point I'm ruling out alternative explanations of just it leaves. I mean, you know, and the reason I want to rule that out is because, for example, exactly that does happen in, say, argon in Vicor. There are crystallographic phase transitions where one layer freezes and the density changes, or there are other ones. In hydrogen, there's an infamous story of somebody seeing superfluid solid hydrogen in Vicor, and when eventually, no, solid hydrogen, and And in a torsional oscillator, and the period suddenly started to change at 11 Kelvin or 10 Kelvin, it turned out that the Vicor was just rejecting the solid the hydrogen. It was just leaving the pores at that temperature. And there's a perfectly good thermodynamic reason for that, but it mimicked it a lot, very nicely. and anyway. And then the final thing on this part of it was, well, way down here at low temperature, the background is constant. It's easiest to work here, actually, it turns out, at this temperature exactly, where the background is temperature independent. It just means that I don't have drifts and stuff if a temperature drifts. And so what I want to do is look there and say, well, okay, what happens if we just cool it down to the lowest temperature, wait for overnight, come back? Does anything move around on the day scale at the lowest temperature? And so the red dots are cooling down to something like 30 millikelvin, and then waiting overnight, coming back up, nothing changes up, and for some reason my data got noisier. And so the conclusion is that on the day time scale at the 30 millikelvin region, there's still nothing moving in or out. Okay, so all of this is just warm up to say that now we were confident in our experiments that nothing funny is just happening by itself. Okay, that it's not something that just happens to happen in pores. And therefore, we want to go on to the more interesting experiment, is how does it flow? And conceptually, the experiment is very simple. You have your Vicor sample with the two electrodes making a capacitor, completely surrounded in the cell by a lot of bulk helium, which acts as a pressure medium. And then you have just essentially the equivalent of a moving piston that you get it all set up frozen, and then you just give it a good squeeze on the outside. You increase the pressure on the outside of the thing and watch whether it flows in response. And John Good kind of would be surprised that it does, right? Because, I mean, it's got, you know, these tiny channels and solid, et cetera. But that's the idea. Freeze the helium in the pores and around it, everything solid, squeeze the outside and look for flow. Now, again, just for the, if you want to know more realistically, in varying degrees of realism, the actual experiment is a lot more like this, okay? I mean, you know, physically, if you're worried about how things are surrounded by helium, et cetera, we actually set the piece of Vicor in this cell on a base, just loosely, just set there with an electrical contact in the top electrode. Then here, and then this is all going to be filled with, around this sample, it's going to be filled with solid helium. And then this is my schematic of a moving diaphragm. Of course, you never use a piston at low temperature. You have a diaphragm that you can push. And we do the pushing with a piezoelectric drive. We actually just put a voltage and just pushes. And that allows us to push this diaphragm, compress the surrounding helium, and then use the capacitance here to measure this. And so, you know, if you go to PowerPoint and put some nuts and bolts on it, it looks like this. And in real life, it's a beryllium copper cell with big, heavy bolts on it.
So you're squeezing this hard enough to actually make a change in the density of the bulk?
Yes.
Helium around the thing.
Yes. The density and pressure, yep. Yeah. Okay, and this is the...
Where's the flow?
Okay, it's going to be flowing in here. I mean, it's sitting on here, but there's a layer of solid helium behind it, so it actually flows in. If you increase the pressure, it's likely to flow in from both sides, through the electrodes.
In the bulk region, it's going to be pretty much static pressure. It's not going to be...
Static stress, yeah. I mean, it may not be uniform pressure at low temperature, but...
What's the difference in the earlier experiment? You also have different pressures.
No, the earlier experiment, I wasn't squeezing anything later, and that by cooling slowly, I believe the pressure was uniform inside and out once it's frozen inside. So that was not a squeezing. All I could do is just cool it down and see what happened. Now after I've done that, I can now add a pressure step outside and see if it flows. So I can do this at low temperature where everything's frozen.
You're going to another part in the phase diagram. In the density pressure phase diagram, you're going to do
another... Well, I don't change the pressure by that much. I mean, I'm going to low temperature. Everything that we can freeze is frozen. And now I'm just with solid outside, solid inside. I'm just squeezing and seeing if it moves. We don't have an actual pressure gauge built into this cell. The evidence is that it's a good fraction of a bar. Not mini bar, not millibar, but
do you have to worry about the Vicor itself compressing?
Yes. A little bit. It's a lot less compressible than helium, but it's not negligible. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and so here, this is a capacitance. So the idea is, this is at various temperatures. So I've got a crystal that freezes. This is at 57 bar when I'm done, when the helium in the Vicor is frozen. It's about where Moses was doing his first experiments. The freezing temperature in Vicor at that pressure is about 2.05 Kelvin. And then what I can do is get everything frozen, and then I can cool down. You know, I can go a little bit, so 1.8 Kelvin, and do a squeeze, or I can warm it up and start over and do it at 1.5, or I can do it at half a Kelvin, I can do whatever temperature I want, squeeze at that temperature. Now, here's what the capacitance or density of the bulk helium is before I squeeze. Here's a jump. There's a sudden jump. No matter what temperature I do, there's always a sudden jump. And then that sudden jump, and this jump occurs faster than I can measure it, meaning within a few seconds. Right? So this is instant on my experimental time scale.
So that's the blue line? It always jumps?
Well, that's the line goes to 0.5, and that's the jump, yeah. It doesn't depend on temperature. And then following that, there's a slower one that does depend on temperature. So the interpretation is that you do have to worry about the compressing. You've just changed the pressure by a bar or something in this. You actually just squeeze the glass down, you push the capacitor plates together, the capacitance goes up. And you can actually, that's actually how we calibrate the pressure jump, is it agrees quite sensibly with what we designed it for. And this jump just corresponds. It's not just the plates coming closer together. The plates also get smaller, the dielectric constant of the Vicor changes with density, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that says that this jump is just purely elastic, instant, has nothing to do with flow. It just means you push the plates of the capacitor a bit closer together as soon as you squeeze. Following that, anything you see after that must be due to the helium flowing around, in or out, in. Okay. So the subsequent flow has to do with the flow of helium, and what you see is that if you do this close to melting at 1.8, within this time scale is minutes, within a minute, 2 minutes, it's all got done what it's doing, and it stays at that pressure then from then on, at that density from then on. And this jump corresponds, this eventual one, that corresponds to roughly the amount you expect the density to flow if, after a couple minutes, the pressure inside and outside have equilibrated. And so that's the surprising thing, I think, you know, if you worry about that within a couple of minutes, it'll flow of the order of half a millimeter or a quarter of a millimeter into Vicor from the outside and equilibrate the pressure. When you cool down, that's no longer true. It gets slower and slower and slower, and by the time you get anywhere significantly below 1 degree, it's slow enough that an hour later nothing's happened. So at half a degree, I could watch this for a long time, but
when you say that jump corresponds, you said a few millimeters. Does that mean the vacancy go all the way?
The helium pressure equilibrates all the way through the whole Vicor in order to do that, yes.
And the difference between the different temperatures, where did it equilibrate?
This keeps going forever. I mean, this is not a...
About that, but 1.3 and 1.5, 1.8, they don't go to the same amount.
Well, this one isn't quite flat either. I mean, if I follow it longer, some of the case I have data for longer. I think they are the same, to be honest, but it's really hard to be sure if they're exactly the same without waiting essentially forever. And
1.1 is bad, sure.
Oh no, but I mean, this is 20 minutes. If I do a daylight, it's still drifting up, right? I mean, what isn't clear is that, you know, it's not a really beautiful exponential you can see, but this one is nowhere near. You know, I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. So I believe that they're all coming essentially to the same density change, but limit to the patients that we could do this at lower temperatures.
Get them to go back down, then you raise.
Oh, we just remove the diaphragm, and they'll come right back. Sorry. Oh, I should have shown that on this. Yeah. So if at this point I now release the diaphragm, it'll come right back down to here. Actually, sure. With the same.
What's happening at 0.5? But there's a big jump.
No. Okay. But the jump I'm saying is nothing to do with flow. It's just simply the fact that I just squeezed the Vicor. I just move the capacitor. I apply external pressure difference. No helium flows in or out. It's still going to elastically compress the capacitor. It does. And I can calculate that. So it's an elastic one, nothing to do with helium flow. After that, it's helium flow. So whether or not that eventually comes to the same thing, I believe it probably will, but we couldn't wait the week or month or something would take it at that temperature to do that.
So this is all in the normal solid phase, and what we're seeing is
this is all
diffusion,
absolutely
the activated vacancy diffusion.
So just, I mean, roughly speaking, you can tell that it's somehow certainly getting slower, right? The time constant goes from a minute or two, you know, to whatever, a time constant of 10 minutes and absolutely more than an hour in this one, et cetera. And, you know, we can follow this further, but we can't follow the whole curve. But ballpark, we can say there's an activation energy, and if you do that, the ballpark activation energy is 9 Kelvin for this kind of flow process, which is a little bit lower than at this pressure, I'd say, a bulk vacancy. I think that's probably more like 14 Kelvin or something at this density. But it's in that ballpark, and you've got disordered layers. It may have a different activation energy, et cetera. Okay, and so once we get down, as I said, below about 0.7 degrees, we don't really, on our time scale of an hour, see anything. So it's all kind of frozen out, the thermally activated part, because of this 9 Kelvin activation energy. And so the interesting point, of course, was not to measure the activation energy of vacancies or whatever. It was to see if all of this as background, no flow at half a Kelvin above where Moses saw anything. Now what happens if we cool? Will we suddenly be able to see flow in this state? And the quick answer is, here's the 1.3 Kelvin that you saw. Here's the 500. Here's where you can see where when I take the diaphragm back, it just goes back where it was. And I do that later here. Here's 75 millikelvin, taken at the minimum of that curve because it's nice and stable, right? There's no temperature drift. And on this kind of noisy scale, you see nothing happens either. And if I take the magnitude of this jump, it's essentially the same, the elastic part naturally. And so we don't see any evidence of flow down. We go to 50 or even 30 millikelvin. The data just has some background drift, so I didn't present it. But we never see any evidence that we see any pressure-induced flow in Vicor, even when we go well below 200 millikelvin. This is probably the longest set of data. This one's one where I did it for 4 hours and et cetera. And so by saying that nothing happens here within the noise, we can put an estimate on how much flow there could have been that we would have missed. In other words, the amount that flow would have to be less than kind of this size. And I convert that into average speed at which the helium would have to flow from the outside into the pores. And the answer is the average speed of all of the helium would be less than about 0.015 nanometers per second, just because we wait 4 hours and it has to move. The Vicor is half a millimeter thick, so from each side it moves 150 microns, etc. You just make some estimates, and that tells us that at low temperature, any temperature below about 0.7, there isn't flow on the scale unless it's less than of that order. Now, if you interpret this as, say, a critical velocity and a critical rho s and a critical velocity, well, if 1% or so, the way Moses saw in the torsional oscillator is rho s, well, moving all of it at 0.015 nanometers per second would have the same effect as moving 1% of it at 1.5 nanometers per second. So, in other words, the critical velocity would be related to the average velocity just by the rho s fraction if you believe this is the critical velocity. So this limit with actually Moses 0.5% decoupling would say that if this were just flow of 0.5% of the helium, a rho s of 0.5%, then it would have to be flowing at less than 3 nanometers per second, not at the kind of velocities that show amplitude dependence in the oscillators.
So the primary quantity you're getting is actually within the error bars of how much it would have flown without really being a signal.
Yeah, so this is a null result, and the limit is put on by what we can exclude by noise.
And given the given size of the thing, you're getting this 0.015 nanometers per second, and then the rest is...
This is the result. I mean, based on a null result, this is an interpretation.
Bottom line, you're trying to interpret essentially a negative result. How much of an upper bound?
It's just an upper bound. Yeah, it's a null result. So I'm putting an upper bound on the average flow. If you want to choose to say that, would you expect this in terms of a 1% or 0.5% rho s moving at a critical velocity, that would be saying that 1% couldn't be moving very fast.
Boosting it by 2 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But this is an interpretation. This is the null result bound here. This is the experimental bound, and it's a null result. Okay, so that's Vicor. So we concluded that we can't see any evidence for this, but of course we're interested in bulk, and I'm sure you've seen this, but the classic experiment which attempted to do this back in the 70s was Dennis Graywall's, and we're going to do something very similar in bulk. So two chambers, a super leak of 2,500 micron diameter capillaries soldered together. That's a super leak. Two chambers with pressure gauges, right? So the pressure range he covered was about from 25 to 50 bar degree different crystals. He went down to temperatures as low as about 30 millikelvin, looked for flow. The way he generated a pressure difference, so the technique was to grow your crystal in these two chambers. The way you grow it, depending on exactly how you block the capillary and your temperature gradient when you freeze, is you can end up with the thing frozen with this pressure different from this pressure. It's all done during growth. You grow in pressure differences of the order of 1 bar, and you can grow higher on the top, lower on the top, depending on...
Is it bulk?
This is absolutely bulk. I mean, bulk in the sense that these are kind of centimeter volumes. These channels are, you know, bulk. You can see them. You can see the hole in them. Right? Okay, so the grown in pressure difference, and then he cooled it. So the idea would be that if you got flow in response to pressure, you grow in a relatively large pressure difference of the order of a bar, Then you cool it, and if it were to start to flow at some temperature, you'd suddenly, you know, at that temperature, see the pressure difference relax as it flowed from one to the other. That was what he's looking for. Another null result. He did not see this. With his sensitivity, he could say that the average flow velocity through these channels was less than 0.25 nanometers. This is almost exactly the same as our limit on Vicor, right? So he, in bulk, put a similar limit back in the 70s on possible flow through these channels. But a few things that I think are maybe significant, or one is that it is grown in. You know, he can't apply the pressure difference at it or do anything with it at low temperature. He just grows it in once, cools it down. No chance to fiddle around with it. Okay, so what we want to do is a sensitive equivalent where we could vary some of these other parameters, hopefully, like how big a pressure difference, how fast you apply it, etc., and apply it at low temperatures. And so we're going to do the mentally the same experiment. And so it's very much like that schematic flow experiment with liquid, right? You imagine making a bunch of channels, your super leak, two chambers. You put a piston on one side. Now, ideally, you would have it move out this side. You'd have pressure difference across it. There's a limit to how much you can do experimentally. So what you have is a closed one here and a pressure gauge on this side. So you apply the pressure on one side, and you're going to look for it flowing through and changing the pressure on the opposite side. That's the experiment that we're going to do. Now, you want a lot of channels. You want a lot of sensitivity. So you'd like to make a lot of capillaries instead of 25 or whatever Dennis Graywall had. So we use a piece of glass that has these beautiful cylindrical parallel capillaries that's called a glass capillary array. They're made somewhere. I think they're made in Ventura. I think. I should get some when I go by.
These are for multiplex.
That's where it started out. The company that started making it was Galileo Electro-Optic, but they gave up the technology for the glass ones to something called Collimated Holes, Incorporated in California, about half a dozen. I think they sell them for, I don't know if they can really make, they don't seem to be doing incredible, I mean, they're not a very big business after a decade or so. Filters, for one thing. Yeah. They're bulk in the sense that I'm going to be, there's bulk helium around, and the channels are, the ones we chose are 25 microns in diameter. They're a little bit smaller than Dennis Graywall's, but 25 microns is pretty bulk macroscopic in helium. And so you see them here, they're going this way. The plate itself is 3 millimeters thick, so they have an aspect ratio of 25 microns diameter cylinders to 3 millimeter long ones, and there's a whole lot of them. And if you look at them from the top, they're pretty regular. They're in actually a pretty nice hexagonal array the way they make them. And if you blow them up, they're not perfect, but they're pretty round, they're very, very uniform and pretty round and nicely arranged. And we've got a lot of them. We got about 30, you know, our particular piece of it, I mean, if you buy one of these pieces like this for $100, you can get a million capillaries in it or something. We have slightly bigger capillaries and a slightly smaller piece, so we have 36,000 capillaries in parallel of those dimensions. The helium, we started out, of course, with everyday helium, 0.3 ppm, presumably helium-3 in it. And then when I was at the low-temperature conference and the ULT conference in Florida, we were going to write it up, but you know, we came back from that saying, yeah, I really should try it with ultra-high purity, or isotopically pure helium, just because there was a worry that purity. So we went to all this trouble. I mean, we had the helium, so we went to all this trouble of doing a whole set of experiments over again with isotopically pure 2 parts per billion helium-3 concentration helium. Now, obviously, you know, we should have done it the other way. We should have added helium-3 or something. But anyway, we went to great effort to do it with isotopically pure helium. So we have done both, though. We've done the natural helium concentration and the 2 parts per billion concentration. Incidentally, we see no difference in any. It's going to be a null result again. But okay, so this is the basic experiment. Again, because I want to show the details a little bit, this is a more realistic version. A relatively large chamber on this side, the same diaphragm and PZT, piezoelectric stack to push it, so we can change the volume in this chamber. This array all epoxied rigidly into place here with 36,000 holes. A small channel or small chamber here so that a small amount of flow changes the pressure significantly. It gives us lots of sensitivity. So in order to improve on Dennis's gray walls, we made a lot more capillaries and a lot smaller volume here. I mean, those are the two essential sensitivity improvements compared to Dennis Graywall's experiment.
Why is making the other chambers smaller?
Well, if you imagine that the helium moves through here 1 nanometer, and this is a honking great chamber, the pressure doesn't change very much. So that's all. So this volume is of the order of 0.5 cm³. This volume is of the order of 0.02 cm³, sort of as small as we can conveniently make it. And some of the parameters that we use, in this case, the pushing on the diaphragm, a typical squeeze pushes this diaphragm in about 1 micron, which isn't very much, but this is only a millimeter or so thick. So it's noticeable. It changes the volume by about 0.1%. That corresponds to a pressure difference here. Don't worry about going through the channels. If I push this in, I can change the pressure in the solid phase by about 0.1 bar, 100 millibar. That's the kind of experimental parameters. It's not a very, it's a gentle squeeze compared to what Dennis Graywall grew in pressure differences, but it's still pretty significant. on this side, we have a capacitor that has a capacitive pressure gauge that can resolve about 0.2 millibar, about 200 microbar noise, or maybe a bit better than that. If you calculate, given the dimensions of this, the sensitivity of this, a noise here, 0.2 millibar, if the pressure changes by that much, that corresponds to helium coming through the channels a distance of about 3 angstroms. Okay, and we can resolve that over, I mean, it's stable. We can come in and come back tomorrow and say, did it move by 1 nanometer? And it'll be visible within the noise.
The distance is moved through the pore.
Through the channel. So that's saying, suppose plugs of all the channels slip by 1 nanometer, then how much does the pressure change? And the answer is about 0.6 millibar, and we'd be able to see it. Okay, so it's quite sensitive and stable. And the one other thing you have to notice is, if I change the pressure on this side and it doesn't flow through, it's going to bend this thing a little bit. It's not perfectly rigid. It's pretty rigid. It's glass and it's solid, but it's not perfectly rigid. It'll flex. If I increase this by the 100 millibar, it turns out, you can estimate it just from elasticity, you can estimate it and it turns out it's going to do it. It will flex significantly. The whole thing will flex by about 30 nanometers bending. And so we're going to see that flex too in our data. And then after that, we're going to look for flow, basically. So it's sort of the analog of this, you know, compressing the Vi-core. There's an elastic effect that we can't get away from. Okay, so here's the thermodynamic path that we follow. This is data again. This particular crystal, we grew the bulk helium. It ended up at 37 bar, freezing at 1.96 Kelvin. And so the first step is to do that, freeze the helium in the whole cell at constant volume block capillary. The second step is that we stop just a little bit below here typically. We cool down, look at how sharp this is, how sharp the end of freezing is, anneal, sit there close to it for a while, run back up and forth to see what happens. So we anneal, in a sense, maybe for a couple hours typically, or sometimes overnight, just whatever's handy, just a little bit below freezing before we do anything, and then we cool to low pressure, low temperature, and do our squeezing. Okay, and so the data I'll show you, I first have to calibrate it here in the liquid phase, just so that I can show you that, you know, how the compression works and calibrate it. Then I go here where I'm just close to melting and do a squeeze and see what happens, and then I go down a low temperature and do a squeeze. And so first step, we do this 1/10 of a bar pressure squeeze with everything liquid. There's no solid anywhere in the cell. And what we see is, here we come, squeeze. This is not flexing. It goes through those holes just fine. And the pressure is transmitted to the whole sample, both chambers, everywhere. This jump corresponds, and it happens in a fraction of a second, instantly, as far as we can tell. And that's what it should. Liquid will go through those channels just fine. And then we unsqueeze here, and it comes right back where it was. So this just corresponds to moving the diaphragm about a micron, compressing the cell by about 0.1%. And we see a pressure change which is of the order of 100 millibar. That's the 100 millibar I was talking about. The next step is we're frozen, but we're close to melting. So we do the same squeeze. Now we see, you know, it does jump pretty quickly, but then it's followed by a relatively quick, but something of the order of an hour later, it's pretty much flattened out. The magnitude of this jump and the magnitude of this jump are similar. That's telling you that this squeezing is applying to both sides. In other words, that the solid helium is going through those channels and pressurizing the other channel. I mean, the fact that these jumps are about the same, in fact, the jump in helium, the pressure is a little bit larger with solid helium. That's because solid helium is a little bit less compressible than liquid. But this we use to tell us that at close to melting, and this is quite close to melting, we can equilibrate the pressure on both sides even though it's solid. Again, we can presumably, something like vacancy diffusion or a liquid layer or something like that allows that to happen. This is within maybe 10 or 20 millikelvin of melting. And this is the next step, which is we compare that data to what happens if we do this at half a degree. Okay, so we do a squeeze, wait, do an unsqueeze, and this jump is the flex. right? This jump is just the fact that even in the absence of flow, and it's buried here, you know, there's a jump here, there's a jump down here, and that's the flexing and unflexing. It's purely elastic. It has nothing to do with flow through the pores. You can estimate it. It makes sense, okay? So this is telling you that the thing flexes, but after that there's no flow. There is no flow through the channels at half a degree, just like there is none in bichord at low temperatures.
Now you should be able to get a good value for the vacancy activation energy, right?
You might think so. I can show you if there's... I'm getting long on time. It doesn't look thermally activated. It looks more complicated than that. Quite a bit more complicated.
It'd be nice to go in the range from like 1 to 1.95 and see if I
Yeah, but it's more complicated. There are experiments by Grigoriev and people like that who move a membrane through solid helium in this range trying to look at activation energies, and they do have sensible results. But this didn't seem... This is more complicated, it turns out. I don't know why exactly. Okay, so once we go below about 1 Kelvin, say at half a Kelvin, we don't see any flow. And again, the attempt is to see what happens at low temperature. So this is data now comparing the half a degree data where you don't expect any superflow, certainly, to the lowest temperature, say 30 millikelvin or something. And this happens to be for the isotopically pure helium. So the blue data is what you've already seen, and the green data is that when you do this at 35 millikelvin, you know, I've offset them just so you can see the both of them, squeezing and unsqueezing, doing it over about a day. So we squeeze, elastic jump, nothing happens. We do it at low temperature, elastic jump, same elastic jump, nothing happens. So there's no difference in flow, i.e. there's no flow that we can detect through the channels at half a degree or at 35 millidegrees. So we've applied 100 millibar pressure difference, looked at 35 millidegrees for almost a day, and we don't see any flow. We could have resolved, as I said, you know, maybe the noise, the drift in noise here may be a little bit bigger, but we could have resolved less than a nanometer if it had happened. And that's over 20 hours. That's a pretty slow average flow. Given that helium, given Moses' results, isotopically pure stuff might not have a transition. So I went back and pulled out yesterday the data from the regular old natural purity. And even though the times are not as long, in the case at 75 millidegrees, there's also data lower. It was sort of half a day, the equivalent at 500 millidegrees. Same answer. We see no flow below TC, or for that matter above it, until you start to get close to melting. We worried that, well, this is a static experiment, you know, you apply a static pressure difference. By the way, we did that, you know, at 100 millibar pressure steps, at 20 millibar, at 4 millibar. We reduced the size of the step and still don't see any flow. So we haven't somehow, you know, squashed it into some immobile state. If I go to lower pressure differences, I don't see anything either. Can't go to much higher. We also did AC. Now, turns out if you do this at, you know, at 300 hertz, you just, with a piezoelectric, you just heat everything up. So we can't do the low temperature experiment at any high frequencies. So by AC, I mean something of the order of hertz or less. But it's still, I can do it more sensitively, actually. I can push and pull very gently, and I can do this. So we oscillated with, you know, something of the order of a few millibar, and then with lock-in techniques and little patience, you can actually get more sensitivity. So what happened is as we cool from half a degree down at, say, 0.1 hertz or a hundredth of a hertz, if something suddenly started to move at half a hertz or a tenth of a hertz, you'd expect that amplitude that gets through to change. This there is an amplitude because of this elastic flexing. So this, in other words, is the little amplitude due to the thing flexing at 4 millibar. It flexes by 1 nanometer back and forth or something like that, right? And we see that, but we don't see anything corresponding to flow. It just is temperature independent. And so we would have been able with this to see a flow at those frequencies more like 0.03 nanometers. That's kind of the noise level, and it didn't change at that level. And so we can say at least at these very low frequencies there's not AC flow at this kind of level. Okay, so just to summarize our experiments, we did sort of these static DC pressure differences, the order of 100 millibar, nothing. We did it with both natural and isotopically pure helium. We haven't added helium-3 to it, but we saw nothing. We tried as much as we could to reduce the pressure difference, to do it as gently as possible, at all scales, at low temperature, at all scales, with the amplitude, but no flow is seen. We tried a bit of low-frequency AC and saw no flow. So we can only conclude that we put a limit on the possible flow by saying it's less than something and for a long time. So just summarizes the limits that we've put on, which are, if this is the actual measured null result upper bound, right? This is the interpretation if you were to try to say, suppose it were 1% or 0.5% or 1.5% flowing at critical velocity. Okay, so Vicor, I mentioned the limit is 0.015 nanometer per second, or a critical velocity of 3 nanometers per second. And although I agree it's a different thing, it's certainly nothing like the 10 micron per second order of the critical velocity seen in the torsional oscillator experiment. These experiments I just talked about in bulk are much more sensitive, actually. So the limit we can put on for the flow, because we can measure sort of a nanometer a day or less than that, is that the flow velocity must, the average flow velocity must be less than 10 to the minus 5 nanometers per second, or the critical velocity, if it existed, would be less than 10 to the minus 3 nanometers per second. It's tough to call this kind of speed any kind of superflow, obviously. I mean, I calculated, I think California is moving west 10 million times faster than that. West? Goes west.
Right? North.
Yeah, north, whatever. It's of the order of 10 million times lower than, you know, geological speed. So it's pretty slow. And if you want, if you want to compare these, the limit that you would say if you were to interpret this torsional oscillator thing as a real critical velocity that had the same meaning as a pressure flow, and I agree it doesn't necessarily, there's a 10 to the 7th order difference between those two possibilities. So our conclusion is that when you apply pressure, and under the conditions we have, there just isn't any flow in response to pressure. So it doesn't. And so I'll stop. I mean, I think I don't want to run, I'm way over, so I don't want to run into time. I have a little bit I can say about annealing and dislocations at some point, but it doesn't have to be today. So one question I have is, you know, just because it decouples in an oscillator, that's a different kind of drive. But on the other hand, I find it really difficult to understand how anything cannot respond to pressure. It's a thermodynamic variable, and that's a pretty sensitive experiment. You could argue that there might be weak links at the channels. We worried about that particularly with Vicor. 25 micron channels are pretty bulk. We know we can diffuse through those, you know, with vacancies. You know, 36,000 channels, we could detect if one of them didn't have a weak link. Like if there were 5,999 were blocked, we could still see it very easily. So it's tough to think that there's some weak link that's like that. And these are really kind of, I think, probably from last week, from what I could gather of listening to the talks, these are clearly issues that we have to look at. So my claim about does it respond to pressure is that I think of pressure as a chemical potential difference. Moses' experiments show that rho s, for example, is pressure dependent. If you compressed one side and rho s is different, et cetera, it's hard to imagine thermodynamically to me why it wouldn't flow, but it appears not to. We know that it does if we're talking about thermal vacancies. If vacancies were involved, I would be completely puzzled how vacancies could not respond to pressure if they were mobile. And no, I think I'll just stop there for time.
Thank you. Any questions?
A simple question. You have established a limit in terms of critical velocity, but the same way you can establish the limit in terms of the amount of matter, because you have a finite sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
So suppose you just suppose everything is just in a super solid state, because an alternative that you just have an insulating crystal,
mm-hmm.
which is also possible. But suppose you have a super solid, you apply some pressure and some amount of matter goes quickly. So you just see the same jump.
Mm-hmm.
The jump contains this portion of matter which just immediately
mm-hmm.
a super fluid.
Yeah.
Right? So suppose critical velocity is not a problem at all. It's not an issue. So it goes immediately and you see something.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a finite sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a very small amount of matter which goes,
mm-hmm.
you cannot measure it.
Okay, so
there should be some limit.
You want him to interpret this now as a small critical velocity. There's a much lower superfluid density than this.
And not the superfluid density, but the small amount, relative amount.
Okay, so
which goes from one chamber
right.
to another.
Because we have an elastic flex, we see a jump, and I think the question is how. If a little bit of a flow, the jump would be there, be a little bit different.
What's your resolution? Because
so. Okay, so the answer is that it's not quite as good. We couldn't be sure that it wasn't 1 nanometer of you know, plugs of the order of 1 nanometer, but we could say maybe 10 nanometers. Like, if you assume that at some temperature, like 1 degree, there's not any of this happening. So we compare what happens at 1 degree or half a degree with what happens at low temperature. Now, that direct comparison isn't quite as sensitive as the numbers I've quoted, but nonetheless, the amount of matter that could move, it could move that matter through those channels of the order of a couple of nanometers. It's unfortunately, like if you were to interpret Mohs' torsional oscillators not as a critical velocity but as a critical amplitude that it could move, it's of that order, I think, of the few nanometers that it moves, and that's roughly our limit on sensitivity. So we're right in the ballpark, but can't rule out. It just moves a little bit and stops. But moves enough to explain Mohs and stops, but it's close. The sensitivity does correspond to a displacement, if you like, of a few nanometers.
How much of a mass you need to display by a few nanometers?
Well, I mean, this of course depends on, you know, our geometry, right? I mean, but we're talking about displacing something of the order of, I don't know, a cross-sectional area of a number of square millimeters by a nanometer. And
in the torsional oscillator, should I take the quoted value for OS and displace it by a few nanometers? You're saying that's, you mentioned some connection to Mohs' experiment on the torsional
oscillator. The torsional oscillator, in a way, it is the coupling of all, you know, in fact, all the superfluid fraction inside the entire annulus.
Yeah.
What Boris is saying is that here, we have a diaphragm here, protractively, assuming the superliquid diaphragm is superliquid, move for the good. The whole thing is what John is saying, the total amount of flexing is only 30 nanometers, the amount of flexing.
Right. And we could see, and we could tell if that changed by a percent. So we could tell if somehow it moved by 0.3 nanometers through it or something like that.
Wait, don't you just reduce by the volume of the helium in the 30 nanometer slide versus your entire chamber?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think I understand Boris' question.
My idea is simple. Once we measure the superfluidity in terms of superfluid fraction, why don't we discuss this effect in terms of the fraction of matter which goes beyond our sensitivity, because our sensitivity is finite. Just in terms of relative number. So you can claim that the relative number like that just doesn't matter. But smaller can, because it's beyond your sensitivity.
So how you can explain this very small velocity? Basically, you want to channel whatever the superfluid fraction that you want to channel at the same time when this flex occurs, at a very short distance, you want to do something and then not see anything after that. No.
But we do have a limit. I can talk to you on the possible displacement as opposed to velocity. Like we know if the helium had moved even immediately, like just instantly, we can say that can't be more than a nanometer or something. I could look up the numbers, but it's of the order of less than a nanometer certainly.
I've got kind of a related question about bounds. I mean, going back to the Andreev mechanism and zero-point vacancies, I mean, you can see the thermally activated one. So if you assume that there was some concentration of zero-point vacancies, what you're getting, it seems to me you're getting an upper bound on that. And that, would that be 10 to the minus 7 or the commensuration, in other words?
Okay, so if you believe that zero-point vacancies responded to a pressure difference the same way, I think it's way less than that, to be honest. I think it's much less than that. I don't.
You sort of have a time scale for the vacancy diffusion, and you just assume that you're missing.
I mean, the thermally activated one you probably have a handle on, like, and in the Vicor you can see it. So
assume that the zero-point vacancies just behave exactly like the thermal ones.
So right. I don't.
There are many, many fewer of them.
What do you mean by exactly like? Does that include the temperature dependence and mobility?
Yeah.
No. I'm saying
they are moving.
So if
I say the mobility. That's what I mean. The mobility is the same. But say the concentration is
mobility the same
epsilon thing. Plus the thermally activated part. And what is epsilon?
So I guess I'd say that we can't resolve the thermally activated ones when we go below, say, 0.7 degrees, so you could argue that the zero-point concentration would have to be of the order or less than the thermally activated one at 0.7 degrees, but I don't have that number on me.
It's
pretty small.
This assumption is pretty strong because there are obvious counterexamples, like a superconductor, right? Well, basically, you have, for instance, quasi-particle that causes energy delta, so you can play all you want with the thermally activated, so like exponentials, but there is a condensate, and so these guys are made out of the same electrons, and they live and behave differently. So, you know, this linear extrapolation of the thermally activated ones into these like zero-point vacancies doesn't have to work.
So,
kind of see how it could not, but I mean, in terms of the balance somehow.
Well, it costs the energy delta to excite the particle out of the ground state. And there is this, like, the energy delta gives you this, like, exponential behavior for thermally activated quantity. And yet there is a finite fraction of these electrons living in the condensate.
Okay, well, thanks, and I think we should move on to talk, right?